Welcome to countries that don't exist anymore, or for our German listeners, willkommen ins Kontrisch, das dis nicht existens anymore.
Your GCSE German paid off, Eddie.
Ja, gut, super.
Super toll.
Super. Wir gehen
ins Kino.
Ice rink.
Das Ice Rink gegangen.
Warning, the accents on this episode do not get any better.
Countries that don't exist anymore, they used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for, it's countries that don't exist anymore.
Where was the Bavarian Soviet Republic?
In Bavaria, Germany.
Wait, let me just check that out. Okay, yep, checks out.
Yes, the Bavarian Soviet Republic sounds cool because Soviet has that classic communist chic. But actually, Soviet just means council, and anything involving the word council just seems much less interesting.
Ambassador, I'd like to introduce you to the esteemed delegates of the Bavarian Council Republic, His Excellency the Secretary of Cycle Lanes and the Minister of Sheds.
Hello.
How long did the BSR last?
1 month, from the 6th of April 1919 to the 3rd of May 1919. If this really were run by local government, that would be just enough time to decide what kind of biscuits everybody wanted.
I've got a packet of chocolate hobnobs.
So how did Bavaria go Soviet?
After defeat in World War I, tensions were high, which led to the breakout of the German Revolution of 1918. This kicked off when sailors were ordered to fight one more battle, but mutinied en masse at ports across Germany.
Was wollen wir machen?
Brot und Mermaidenfrau.
Only a year before, the Russian Revolution had happened, and throughout Europe, dangerous lefty ideas were doing the rounds. Since the Kaiser had abdicated, Germany was hungry, angry, and ready for radical change. Armed unrest was popping up all over the place, like the leftist Spartacus revolt in Berlin, and this was more than the new Weimar government could handle. The old order was being swept away, leaving the door open for a brave new world. In all the tumult, King Ludwig III of Bavaria fled Munich.
Run away! Run away! Run away!
Ludwig's family had been ruling Bavaria for more than 900 years, but he just kind of buggered off.
See ya!
Into the vacuum came theatre critic Kurt Eisner, who led a strike that turned into a peaceful coup, declared a socialist republic, and sort of just wandered into the seat of government and sort of just decided to form something called the People's State of Bavaria.
Hang on. What was the People's State of Bavaria, and why aren't we doing an episode on it?
Well, the Soviet Republic of Bavaria kind of just formed out of it. But to understand why that happened, we have to get what the People's State was all about. So really, this episode is about both these little states because they are inextricably linked. And, just to be even more confusing, the People's State of Bavaria was a rival to the Soviet Republic of Bavaria because at one point, they existed at the same time.
What the bloody hell are you talking about?
We'll come to that. The Soviet Republic was straightforward communism, or as straightforward communism as communism gets, which isn't very. Kurt Eisner, though a socialist, didn't really seek to impose a system other than...
1.
There was direct democracy.
2.
Everything was to be discussed.
3.
Decisions were made by normal people, like people and sailors. Little note here, there were a lot of soldiers in the area. Munich was a staging post for soldiers returning from war. This was another reason the city was a hotbed of revolution straight after the war. For the most part, both the left and the right, the communists and the monarchists, were okay to let Kurt Eisner just get on with it. War had pretty much exhausted everybody. Most people just wanted peace, stability, and to get on with their lives. Eisner wasn't really a threat. He wasn't seizing property or guillotining anybody, quite the opposite really. Eisner loved to have plenty of concerts, parades and speeches, but he didn't really like to do the actual governing bit. In Catholic, conservative, rural Bavaria, many weren't exactly delighted with a bunch of lefty Jewish intellectuals fooling about with the levers of power in Munich. With strikes against the government, many saw this as a period of anarchy. Munich became an attractive destination from hippies from all over Europe, who had heard that a theatre critic could play president. Eisner said he wanted government by kindness and would create a realm of light, beauty and reason. Naturally, the nationalist right thought he was a total drip and wanted him gone, generally preferring government by cruelty. But as they say, you've got to be cruel to be kind. They being cruel people.
Oh, President Eisner.
But Eisner didn't really help his own cause. For example, he admitted German guilt for the First World War and published papers showing how Germany had pushed for war. As well as talking Germany down and being a socialist, Eisner was also Jewish. Those are the top three family fortune answers for what do German nationalists of the early 1900s most hate? His utopianism didn't catch on either. Holding election 3 months into administration, he got 2.5% of the vote. Things got even worse for Eisner when, on his way to resign, he was assassinated.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, bummer.
Well, yeah, what a kick in the teeth. Ironically, the assassin was a proto-Nazi who was trying to prove himself to other proto-Nazis who wouldn't play with him because he had a Jewish grandfather.
Again with the Jews.
I know, they're obsessed. With Eisner firmly out of the picture, the overall winner of the elections, Johannes Hoffmann, became president. Surely a man who had been elected by the populace would bring peace and stability to Bavaria.
How long did Johannes Hoffmann last in power?
1 month.
Oh.
Or 12 months.
Eh?
Hoffmann actually took office in March 1919, but then he had to flee to Bamberg when there was an uprising against him, and that's when the Bavarian Soviet Republic was announced. So really, there were two governments and two competing states that existed at the same time. On the one hand, there was the People's Republic, and on the other hand, the Soviet Republic.
I see. So it's like, sort of like how Superman was both Christopher Reeves and Dean Cain, because they were alive at the same time.
Yeah, okay, sure. So, a bit about Hoffmann.
Oh, sorry.
Who was Johannes Hoffmann?
Thank you. Socialist Hoffmann, who'd served as Minister of Education in Eisner's government, was an anti-militarist and former schoolteacher. Forming a coalition government on the 7th of March 1919, things didn't last long before communists and anarchists declared a Soviet Republic, mainly encouraged by a left-wing revolution in Hungary. So now we get to the actual Bavarian Soviet Republic.
So was this the actual Soviet Bavarian Republic?
Sort of.
Oh, come on!
So, the Soviet Republic itself had two stages. First, we have the government of Ernst Toller, who became chief of state. So, like Eisner, the theatre critic, and Hoffmann, the poet, Toller was a playwright. When you think about it, it makes sense. Playwright overthrows the work of a theatre critic.
Convoluted, was it? Amateurish? When I'm Bavarian president, you'll be first against the wall.
I'm sure it was in no way personal. Though Toller had fought in the trenches in World War I, this didn't seem to make him very good at recruitment. For example, his foreign affairs deputy, Dr. Franz Lipp, had formerly been a patient in a psychiatric hospital and once wrote to Russian leader Vladimir Lenin complaining that Johannes Hoffmann had fled to Bamberg with the key to the ministry toilet, to which Lenin replied,
"We thank you for your message of greetings and on our part wholeheartedly greet the Soviet Republic of Bavaria. With sincere greetings and wishes of success, Lenin. P.S. I don't know where your toilet key is. Have you looked in the back of the sofa? Also, is there a McDonald's nearby you could use?"
Genuine letter, except for the P.S. bit. Franz Lipp used his time in office productively. Highlights include declaring war on Württemberg and Switzerland for the Swiss refusal to lend Bavaria 60 locomotives. Writing to a fellow minister, he said,
"My dear colleague, I have declared war on Württemberg and Switzerland because those dogs have not immediately handed over the 60 locomotives to me alone. I have no doubt that we will be victorious. Furthermore, I will seek the blessing of the Pope, who is a good friend of mine, for this victory."
100% true letter.
Unbelievable.
Absolute batshit. And that didn't end the ridiculous for Toller's government. It was a massive merry-go-round of people totally unqualified for their posts. For example, the Missioner for Military Affairs was a former writer. The police president was a former burglar.
Takes one to know one, I guess.
And that principle holds true for the Commissioner for Transportation, who was a part-time rail worker.
I bet he told all his mates, when they put me in charge, I'll make sure we get proper portaloos with plenty of toilet paper. You'll see. But then when they actually got in power and looked at the budget and he thought, I mean, are toilet breaks even strictly necessary?
Happens to the best of us when we seize power.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the man in charge of Bavaria...
Sorry, that was a northern German.
Yeah, this is from the north of Germany. Ja, Brot und Tripping. Meanwhile, the man in charge of Bavaria's Catholic schools was Jewish, which doesn't really sound like an issue in of itself. But unfortunately, in Germany in 1919, anti-Semitism was pretty damn rife. Now, although letters to and from Lenin may suggest fellow travellers writ large, the Soviet Republic of Bavaria was hardly following the communist playbook. Toller initially went with an open government approach, saying,
let the people come and tell me how to change the world.
So, and this is serious, Ernst Toller set himself up in the bathroom of the palace to let people tell him their ideas. Why the bathroom? Well, he felt that sitting himself in one of the larger throne rooms would make it seem like he was putting himself above the people. It does leave you to wonder where he actually sat in the bathroom, though.
So, Herr President?
Kurt, please.
Kurt, I was thinking about the state of the roads. You see, I run an up-and-coming pencil shop business. Kurt?
I'm listening. Hey, could you be a helpful fellow comrade and see if there's any toilet paper out there, possibly? Could you?
After a day of enduring pretty crazy suggestions, Toller decided to just come up with the laws on his own. And there were plenty.
So, what were the laws of the Soviet Republic of Bavaria, Mark 1?
So, law number 1 was no new house could be built with more than 3 rooms. Number 2 was living rooms must always be positioned above the kitchen and bedroom. 3 was all cafes to close at 6 p.m.
Or even Pret.
Even Pret.
Blimey.
Number 4, the teaching of history was banned at Munich University as it was deemed hostile to civilization. Number 5, capitalism was to be brought down by Freigeld or making money free.
Free money? It's absurd.
Yes.
Crazy.
I know.
Free money. Money can't be free. Money has to have a meaning. It has to be earned.
No, I mean, not unless you're an investment banker or a global bank or a Western government.
Exactly.
More sensible, from a let's make this thing last point of view, he called upon the Bavarian Red Army to support the new state and stamp out any counter-revolutionary efforts, probably thinking of Hoffmann in Bamberg.
What was the Bavarian Red Army?
Well, it didn't actually exist, but Toller reckoned if you built one, it would come.
Oh, just like if you'd say an advert on a podcast, the money will roll in.
I mean, I don't think it's the same thing, but sure. Either way, the Bavarian Red Army didn't exactly bring peace and stability to the new republic. Deciding that their barracks weren't quite up to scratch, they took up residence in local schools instead.
So 2 and 2 is 4.
Oh, sorry. I thought, you know, somebody said war.
Despite the general confusion, the fledgling republic didn't cause much of a fuss elsewhere. The central government of the German Weimar Republic were way too busy trying to deal with street fighting in Berlin against much more militant communists. And despite its barking mad government, Toller wasn't actually doing all that much harm. The old imperial civil service in Munich had survived the war and were pretty much getting on with things as usual, so things kept running. Plus, despite the communist branding, Toller's lot weren't actually doing much of the property seizing, bloodletting, or redistribution associated with the Russian Revolution. Toller liked to play the part of the Bavarian Lenin, but didn't really follow through on the programme. All this was to change, however. So, just 6 long days into his government, Toller was pushed aside by bona fide revolutionary Eugene Levine, and the Bavarian Soviet Republic entered its final stage.
Who was Eugene Levine? Assuming that's how you pronounce it.
Eugene Levine was a revolutionary communist born to a Jewish family in St. Petersburg, Russia. He'd fought in the failed Russian Revolution in 1905 and was exiled, subsequently sheltering in Germany. After serving in the war, he joined the German Communist Party. When Levine took power, Lenin said, upon the 2nd anniversary of the Russian Revolution,
The liberated working class is celebrating its anniversary not only in Soviet Russia, but in Soviet Bavaria.
And probably also.
And don't ask me about the fucking toilet key either.
Levine hadn't been totally impressed with the antics of the Soviet Republic up until now. He said,
"In the factories, the workers toil and drudge as ever before the capitalists. In the offices sit the same royal functionaries. In the streets, the old armed guardians of the capitalist world keep order. The scissors of war profiteers and the dividend hunters still snip away. The rotary presses of the capitalist press still rattle on, spewing out poison and gall, lies and calumnies to the people craving for revolutionary enlightenment. Not a single bourgeois has been disarmed. Not a single worker has been armed."
But Levine didn't just rock up and decide to take over. Power change happened during the defense of Munich from the invasion masterminded by Hoffmann's competing People's State of Bavaria. Even after this transfer of power, Ernst Toller was still prominent in the Soviet Republic. Remember, this was a council republic. None of the men we have mentioned thus far were out-and-out dictators. In the face of this invasion, Levine's rather more serious communists came to the aid of Toller's Dead Poet Society. Rebuffing the first Freikorps attack, these rather more committed communists decided that they were better placed to defend and govern. For the Soviet Republic of Bavaria, it was no more fun and games. Inspired by the Russian Revolution, Levine went to work.
What were the laws of the Soviet Republic of Bavaria, Mark II?
Luxury flats were seized and given to the homeless, which is bad, obviously. Factories were to be run by joint councils of workers and owners and workers' control of industry. Obviously. Bank withdrawals were to be carefully controlled.
That's what I try to live by as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't have that much money, really. Mm. Plans were drafted to abolish paper money.
Oh, so contactless, basically.
Sounds like it.
Doesn't sound too bad. Mm.
During Levine's rule, the problem of food shortages that afflicted much of post-war Germany became even more of a problem, especially the milk shortages. Never keep a German from their milch.
How am I supposed to pull my radical rollerblade Trixon in Centrum without my 10 a.m. power smoothie?
Levine's attitude to public criticism over the milk shortage didn't help him much either. He said,
"What does it matter? Most of it goes to the children of the bourgeoisie anyway. We are not interested in keeping them alive. No harm if they die. They'd only grow into enemies of the proletariat."
Politics lesson number one. Never try to be blasé about dead children. Unless it's foreign dead children. Hoffmann was none too pleased with what Levine was up to, blocked supplies from entering Munich and gathered 8,000 soldiers that were defeated by a force of 30,000 Red Army troops led by Ernst Toller. Having lost the physical invasion, Hoffmann started a propaganda war. Posters and leaflets started to fall from the sky, dropped from biplanes. Some of them read,
"The Russian terror rages in Munich, unleashed by alien elements. This shame must not endure for another day, another hour. Men of the Bavarian mountains, plateaus and woods, rise like one man. Head for recruiting depots. Signed, Johannes Hoffmann."
The man knew nothing about advertising. I mean, where's the upbeat ukulele music in the background?
So, like, sometimes it's kind of good to share stuff with the people we love. Friends together, sharing special times. But when it comes to heavily armed soldiers drunk on potato moonshine evicting you from your luxury apartment while a cackling old crone with rotten teeth and stinking cabbage breath darns your most Instagrammable moo-moo into a communist flag, I'm like, guys? Capitalism?
Meanwhile in Munich, thousands of rifles were handed out so the revolution could be defended. And as we know from the NRA, more guns equals more peace. Levine justified this action at his trial.
"Why, having gained power, do we build a Red Army? Because history teaches us that every privileged class has hitherto defended itself by force when its privileges have been endangered. And because we know this, because we do not live in cloud cuckoo land, because we cannot believe that the conditions in Bavaria are different, that the Bavarian bourgeoisie and the capitalists would allow themselves to be expropriated without a struggle, we were compelled to arm the workers to defend ourselves against the onslaught of the dispossessed capitalists."
That's all very well, Mr. Levine, but I just asked you to state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry.
All cars had been seized for official purposes. Armed workers marched about the place. Lorries of armed workers were buzzing around town, being cheered by other armed workers. In summary, there were armed workers. Hoffman and his Free State of Bavaria weren't put off by the initial defeat and teamed up with 20 to 30,000 Freikorps troops, just spoiling for a fight.
Who were the Freikorps?
Ah, good question, because I've mentioned them a few times now. When the armistice was called and Germany accepted defeat, not everybody got the memo. Out in the Baltic, some German soldiers were fighting on, apparently unconvinced by this whole "you lost" thing.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win.
Many soldiers didn't feel particularly defeated, including one young corporal called Adolf Hitler, who you may have heard of.
Who?
Rather than giving in, the Freikorps were on the rampage, looking for new enemies. And, with a raging nationalist anger, the antics of the Soviet Republic looked like a pretty good target. And the Freikorps were in no way dissuaded by the Weimar Republic, who were happy to let the attack dogs on the Red Menace, something they would pay for in the long term. Spoilers, Nazis. In a second assault, this anti-communist alliance, known as the White Guards of Capitalism by the communists, had much more success, taking the city of Dachau and surrounding Munich. Now, in a siege situation, Levine's Bavarian Soviet Republic started to weed out the quote-unquote disloyal elements in their midst. This included aristocrats and nationalists of the right-wing Thule Society, who were to be held as hostages. Panicked by the surrounding forces, six hostages were executed, including the well-connected Prince Gustav of Thurn and Taxis, cousin of Reichsmarschall Minikab von Uber. The executions broke any remaining unity in the Bavarian Soviet Republic. Ernst Toller was strictly against the executions, just as he'd been against the last stages of the Bavarian Revolution in general. He said,
"I consider the present government a disaster for the Bavarian toiling masses. To support them would, in my view, compromise the revolution and the Soviet Republic."
The White Guards broke through the city defences, leading to an all-out war in the city, including flamethrowers, heavy artillery, armoured vehicles and aircraft. People were shot on sight without trial. At least 600 people died, with half that number being civilians. The anarchist dream turned into a bloody nightmare, with up to 1,000 deaths in the 4 weeks of Levine's Bavarian Soviet Republic. Communist leaders either died in the fighting, or were then tried and executed. Between 1 and 2,000 communists and anarchists were executed. Others served long prison sentences, totaling 6,000 years in all. At his trial, Ernst Toller argued,
"We revolutionaries acknowledge the right to revolution when we see that the situation is no longer tolerable, that it has become frozen. Then we have the right to overthrow it. The working class will not halt until socialism has been realized. The revolution is like a vessel filled with the pulsating heartbeat of millions of working people, and the spirit of revolution will not die while the hearts of these workers continue to beat. Gentlemen, I am convinced that, by your own lights, you will pronounce judgment to the best of your knowledge and belief. But knowing my views, you must also accept that I shall regard your verdict as the expression not of justice, but of power."
This impressed the judges so much that Toller got away with 5 years in prison. I guess if they sentenced him to death, he could have said,
"See?"
In prison, he used the time productively, writing some of his best plays.
Hey Ed, maybe you could use some time in prison. It seems to take you about a year to write one podcast episode.
Nice one, Phil.
That gives me an idea. How about you make us a cup of tea?
Okay, seems a bit unconnected. I'll just get the teacups.
Yeah, that's right. Leave the room.
Sorry,
Hello? Yeah, police? Yeah, I'd like to report a crime. His name's Ed O'Mara. What's the crime? Well, what gets you 5 years in prison with monthly podcast recording visits? Interesting. Yeah. And the writing desk comes with that, you say? Oh, hang on.
Here you go.
Oh, hey, Ed.
Got some tea.
Thank
some
you.
Some steaming mugs of tea for my most beloved brother. He would never abandon me. He would always be there for me. He would never turn his back on me.
It's cold.
Oh, sorry, I didn't know you didn't ask for hot tea.
Huh.
Head of the invading army, Burghard von Oven, declared the city...
Who was Burghard von Oven?
No, we're not doing that now. I'm wrapping up.
Oh, sorry, just thought it sounded funny. Oven. Burger oven, burger van oven. Maybe you could do something with that.
Declared the city secure on the 6th of May, and there ended the Bavarian Soviet Republic.
Oh, right, sorry, yep.
Although Hoffmann was restored as head of a new free state of Bavaria, wrapped firmly within the German state, Bavaria was not to be some socialist dreamland. The right now held sway in Bavaria, so much so that one Adolf Hitler, you know Phil?
Who?
Centered his new movement in Munich. 4 years later, he chose Munich for his putsch, with the idea of marching on Berlin from there.
Why didn't the Bavarian Soviet Republic last longer?
Well, first and foremost, Bavaria wasn't the natural spot for a left-wing revolution. Tetschi factory workers were only a feature of Munich itself. Outside of the city, Bavaria was a land of red-faced conservative Catholic farmers who didn't much care for the lefty Jewish rabble in Munich, as they saw it. Even Levine doubted the establishment of a Soviet Republic in Bavaria was even a good idea, and only came to its defence when it was threatened. Thereafter, he tried to rush through some Leninist actions to try to make the Soviet Republic a more legitimately communist idea. But it was all a bit shutting the gate after the bourgeoisie had bolted. But really, the different incarnations of the Soviet Republic and its predecessor in the People's Republic showed that the only thing that united revolutionary elements in this part of the world at this place and time is that they really don't know what they wanted, and they really didn't know how to achieve it.
What was the legacy of the Bavarian Soviet Republic?
The failed experiment in Bavaria turned the public opinion in Germany more solidly against the left, probably allowing the Nazis to sneak in through the back door. Although seizing nice apartments and executing aristocrats isn't the answer to anybody's problems, it's unfair to characterise the Bavarian Soviet Republic as some blood-soaked Stalinist regime, when, even in its final incarnation, much of the death and chaos came when the Freikorps were let loose on the streets of Munich. The fact that some of the Bavarian Soviet Republic's notables were also Jewish did much to add petrol to the fires of anti-Semitism, with dreadful consequences. Post-war Germany offered a brief window of time when there was just enough anarchy and just enough of a power vacuum and just enough exhaustion with the old order that, just before that window was slammed shut, anything seemed possible. Poets and playwrights could be revolutionaries and presidents. The common man on the street might take control of his destiny, and a former asylum inpatient could declare war on Switzerland because of some trains. Oh, and they never did find that toilet key.
Sitting on the toilet in Munich, trying to get the people a break. Levine stood and hollered, W.S. Toller, your Soviet Republic's a fake. Hans, you know it ain't easy, you know utopia's a pain. The way things are going, we'll invade the Swiss over trains. Hunting up fried old willy-nilly, closing all the cafes at 6. Last night the Frau said, or else you dickhead, you made Scheiße's cabinet picks. But you know it ain't easy to be a revolutionary. And Franz is complaining that he can't find the toilet key.
Yes, thanks for joining us, listeners, on another episode of Countries That Don't Exist Anymore. Join us next time when we'll be joined by an extra special guest. So make sure you tune in. Join us online at our socials, ctdeapod.com, at ctdea, on the Twitter and on the Facebook. Join us there. Join us.
Countries that don't exist anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's countries that don't exist. Oh!